The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello. Welcome, everyone, again to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am, of course, your host, John Schmidt. And again today, as most weeks of the last 3+ years, I'll be taking you out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those that you know I always like to say are rich with the essence of constant renewal. Well, we are back again on a midsummer Monday, a scorcher here over the weekend on the west coast of Florida, but actually calm in comparison to other parts of the world. It is hard not to begin today with mention of and perhaps even a heartfelt concern for those in Aurora, Colorado. Those here in the United States living with the reality of the movie theater massacre, and hard not to open our hearts to those in other parts of the world as well who are living similarly daily amidst a lot of this turmoil and pain that comes from the conflicts going on, Syria and Lebanon and so forth. But a year ago, just over a year ago, in Norway, we had a similar shooting and massacre on the island, if you recall. A friend of mine from the Diamond Approach work actually had a son on that island who really swam away. So I know the sense and feeling without having been there. I know the emotional context of what comes out of the kinds of things that happened at Aurora. It's one that certainly is touching, and that's a heartfelt experience along the way. And in some respects, for all of us, it sort of reinforces the sense at times that the world can be a dangerous place with these kinds of experiences, and perhaps things are even getting worse. But I'd like to open the show with a perspective that things are getting worse, perhaps, and things are getting better. And perhaps that's the build on to where we left last show about the nature of possibility in talking about a third industrial revolution. But let me just give a couple of sense here of things really are getting worse in some ways. And economically, as we were talking about last week and the week before that, on Friday, economist Nouriel Roubini, both in a call I was on with him and in some writings that he actually did and pointed to actually on CNBC this morning, that America and especially many economists and financial prognosticators have been and still are pie in the sky about the U.S. economy and the self-sustaining recovery that we're leading into and living into. Predictions of the growth have been and seem to continue to be wrong, as he said, and at best, what we're going to find in years to come is a below-trend experience. I think that's the kind of thing we've been working on, but actually even more so than just below-trend. Nouriel had a great piece, folks, Project Syndicate on Friday. The conference call was actually likewise stimulating about Europe, but the sense I will leave you with is things are getting worse, and if, as we've even begun to see the market correction going on here today, if in fact we were to have a huge or very significant equity correction, as he said, if the U.S. starts to sneeze, the rest of the world begins to catch pneumonia. And that's because of the weakened immune system and Europe's debt and the emerging countries and the slowdown that's gone with them. But that's kind of the view we've been talking about. Things are getting worse. And the reflections on something like Aurora and in Norway a year ago, we have that sense of it. But simultaneously, things are getting better. Highlighted, I think, to me, perhaps no better than this last weekend by an initial look at Peter Diamandis and his new book, Abundance, and the work he's been doing with Singularity University. And where I think Peter is describing the amazing, rather breathtaking, and I've got to even tell you at times, really unbelievable advances going on in an array of the sciences and the technologies, from artificial intelligence to robotics to infinite types of computing to ubiquitous broad-based networks, digital manufacturing, things we've talked about, nanomaterials, biotech, all of that. But the point I want to make is things are getting worse, things are getting better, and soon on the planet, and I think Abundance is a view in his book about that, that soon we are going to have the capacity on the planet, technology-wise and collaboration-wise, to meet and exceed the basic needs of every man, woman, and child on the planet. Abundance for all is within our grasp. And I would say, relative to Zoomed, it is connected and further enabled by both positive individual and collective forces of leadership that we have been talking about for some years. And with that, things are getting worse, things are getting better. I think last show I left with the notion of possibility. A view, a particular view in this case by Rifkin, beyond the rope-a-dope dynamics, I think, of what we're seeing in the political campaigns here with Obama and Romney. I don't think that they're really giving us the view. And as I described, a new third industrial revolution is possible. And that's what I want to continue us to put our attention to today, to begin to flush out more of what Jeremy Rifkin was describing about the potential of a vision that could provide both a means of paying down our debt and transforming the economy into something that provides the leap and the growth for the future. I think it gives us possibilities at hand, and I want to talk more about that today. My guest, though, to do this is Raymond Kaiser. He is a friend, a colleague, someone I think is conscious in this, but moreover, can provide some more on-the-ground, sort of in-the-street sort of perspectives relative to Rifkin's view and the vision that we started to launch. Raymond, in particular, is the Director of Green Building Services at Steward Engineering here in the U.S. and in Florida. He's also an adjunct professor of energy technology management at the State College of Florida. He's experienced, and actually, I would say from my experience of the last 3 years, he's gifted in his capacities and his focus and flow and means of putting together design and development on a wide range of issues and attentions about what we're talking about, renewable and sustainable technologies and energies. He's been involved in all kinds of projects, from LEED projects, 25 or more green building council kinds of projects. He's been involved with the U.S. Department of Energy and the smart grid and thinking about the electric power utilities, how that might be evolved. And I think, as I always like to do with guests on here, it's to acknowledge where we have it. Raymond is of the conscious underpinning that we talk about and the groundbed of attentions that Zooms comes from and our life in general. Raymond, great to have you on the show today.
Well, John, thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here today.
Well, I think we introduced the notion, the five pillars, as we talked about last week with Jeremy Rifkin. Maybe I'll go back to those in a minute, but Raymond, what was your sense? I know we've talked a little bit about this, but general observations, this is one vision, one view of possibility. What's your sense of it?
Well, you know, it's interesting, John, because I've got really two different responses. You know, you were kind of talking about the glass half full and half empty. In the one hand, when I look at his five pillars, you know, I'm working on projects today, not only at the street level, but really in the trenches, literally digging trenches to create basically a small campus that really embodies a lot of really all of the five pillars that he's talking about. At the same time, I'm certainly frustrated, and Jeremy Rifkin identifies this in the book, of the kind of social, political, economic challenge of actually getting the kind of breakthrough understanding that it would take to really accelerate our transition to a sustainable and renewable economy.
And Raymond, is it for lack of understanding, do you think? And maybe I'll go back and introduce the pillars for guests that might not, or our listeners that might not have been there last week. But what's your sense about not even being able to hold the view here?
Well, I think it's twofold, John. I think one is whenever you have a period of tremendous uncertainty, there's always a lot of people that want to maintain the status quo, which is not a bad thing. I mean, if you have a complex society of any type, You always need those people who will kind of represent and preserve that which is best within a society and a culture. At the same time, we also have some very significant economic interests. So if you look at the power industry, it's actually the largest concentration of capital investment in the world. And then if you look at oil in particular, because that's the fifth pillar that he talks about in terms of shifting to fuel cell cars and electric vehicles, oil is the most valued commodity traded in the world. So you're looking at the power sector and you're looking at the oil and gas industry, and there's a lot of invested capital in both of those industries, and so there's a real reticence to rethink the fundamental principles of one's very successful business model.
Right on, Raymond. And maybe I'll just summarize again. There were five pillars described to this for those of you that hadn't listened to last week's show yet. Pillar one is a shift to renewable energies, solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, biomass, a mix of them. Pillar two is about transforming the building stock of every continent into micro power plants, what Raymond was just beginning to introduce about on the street kinds of things. Third is about deploying means and storage technologies to deploy hydrogen and other kinds of storage technologies so that you can actually integrate those into the buildings and into the infrastructure at large to deal with sort of intermittent resources of some of these resources, the renewable resources. Fourth, it's about putting together a large internet technology-based power grid that actually connects it all together. And the fifth, as Raymond was talking about, is a transition to a transport fleet that can include electric plug-ins and fuel cells, but actually then operate and associating with this grid. So there are five. There's some different pillars here, but some possibilities of that, Raymond. And I'm wondering just of maybe even take the first one to renewables. And for those that aren't even familiar like you are with the nature of energy, what's your sense of the possibility of engaging the degree and the level of renewables on the planet that Rifkin is suggesting?
Well, it's daunting. I mean, it's ambitious. It's as daunting as when John Kennedy in 1960 says, we will put a man on the moon in 10 years. We were able to do it, but it was a tremendous amount of research and development and good engineering and a fairly significant commitment of capital resource. And so he's asking us, it's a stretch goal. So that's the simple answer. And yet when I look at what's happened over the last 10 years, it's extraordinary. We now have wind power that's actually competitive with grid power. And in many markets, solar power is actually competitive. Just 3 years ago, the average, this is before any subsidies or discounts, the average cost of solar was $8 a watt, and today it's at $4. And so I've seen that we've had a tremendous progress, and we're ahead of the cost curve that many people projected as little as 5 years ago. So I think it's certainly possible, and yet there's still a reticence to get in with both feet. Some of that is because of a natural caution that people have in terms of something that seems new and risky, and yet wind power, solar power are both pretty well-established technologies. Wave power, I mean, there's some leading-edge stuff that we're working on, but in terms of wind and solar, the understanding of how to do it is pretty well-established at this point in time. The first solar cell is still orbiting the Earth and still working on a satellite that NASA launched in the 50s.
And Raymond, let me break in there because I can hear the music in the backdrop here. But I think what you're providing a perspective on is we have a vision that's a stretch goal, a stretch vision, and that's really what I really want to start with. But you're starting to provide some underpinnings about what's there. But folks, let's take a short break. Let's come on back. Raymond Kaiser, our guest today, really getting on the ground a little bit more about what is really going on, particularly here in the U.S., but in other realms about the nature of what this possibility might be. Take a short break. Come on back, folks. You're on Zoomed.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. The Zoomed Leadership Conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership, capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com. There's a course offered on Seventh Wave Network that you never saw offered in college. One that provides information on how to transform ancient wisdom teachings into everyday life. You'll learn how to create from your spirit and explore the world with all of your senses. Participation is encouraged. Enroll in Spirituality 101, the course you can't afford to miss, with your host, Reverend Norma. Classes in session every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time, in your favorite classroom, Seventh Wave Network.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoom today, we are in the land of possibilities. We are in the land of some things are getting worse, some things are getting better. There is possibility and potential, and we do have the need for a larger vision, which is what I suggested in terms of Jeremy Rifkin as one potential and possibility. Raymond, you started to frame up the nature of renewables. There's all kinds of growth, and there's possibility going on. I'm wondering if we can even put this into an example for folks, maybe a project that you're on. That do you have one that has a set of renewables and different elements that might even begin to sort of span these piers to bring it alive and talk about the possibility and how this actually works?
Sure, John. I actually have a project I'm working on that embodies all five of the pillars. There was a British couple, Lizzie and Mike Thrasher, who bought four historic buildings and are building a fifth. So it's a small campus, five buildings, and they committed to do LEED Platinum, which is a designation for how green the project is, and that's the highest designation, and a net zero energy project. Net zero energy means it's a mini power plant, but not only is it a mini power plant, but it will produce more power in a given year than it actually uses. And in addition to that, we have geothermal cooling. And so the renewable energy component is very well represented in that we currently have about 70 kilowatts of solar PV. Typically a home, you know, might need a 5 or 7 kilowatt system to be net zero energy. So we've got a lot of PV. We're going to be adding some more solar. And when I say solar PV, it's basically a silicon substrate that converts sunshine into electricity. We have geothermal cooling. So we use natural temperature of the earth to both heat and cool the buildings, which is incredibly energy efficient. We're using internet technology so that we can monitor in real time how much power we're using. And then when we overproduce during the day, we sell that back to Florida Power and Light at full retail rates. We have a battery storage technology so that we don't get dinged with a demand charge from FPL. So if all of a sudden we're going to be using more than 20 kilowatt hours, we'll bring in the batteries to basically shave our peak load. And we're doing other things to drive down demand in the project. And there's an electric charging station right on site and right next door, Lizzie and Mike on the property, where people are renting electric golf carts and electric bicycles. So in this very small project of five relatively modest buildings, we actually have a project that embodies all five pillars.
Okay, this is great, Raymond, because this is what, you know, we can start and we can get in the clouds the larger picture as I was describing last week. And I think it's important to start there because that's the vision. That's the vision that he's been engaging and Europe has really committed to work in this direction. But to understand this more locally, how we can get our hands around it and understand it feels to me like it's important to recognize that. What was involved for this pilot project to get it started? You're talking about there are renewables here, PV and geothermal. You're talking about some sort of a storage in the background. You're talking about then some way to manage it technologically. If someone were to think about doing this for another project of their own, how do they begin to get their hands around this and to think about it? Is it just start with that vision and then start to implement it from that context? I mean, how did this begin?
Passion and money. So there was, you need a sufficient level of passion and commitment to want to really do things differently, which in this case we had an owner, Mike and Lizzie had actually established an organic baby food company in the UK in the 90s and were very successful, sold it, came to Anna Marie Island and fell in love with the place. Because it's one of the islands, as you probably know, John, it's one of the islands that haven't seen the development gorilla pave it all and put in high rises. It's really kept a very wonderful charm, a real intimate atmosphere. So they fell in love with the place, and rather than bulldoze historic buildings, they said, we're going to preserve these buildings, but also show that we can integrate the latest thinking in terms of climate change and renewable energy on this project. So that was a passion, and they had the financial wherewithal and resources to commit to the project. And it's that combination. There's no technological barrier to creating a sustainable future. There are political barriers, there are financial challenges, there are regulatory challenges, but it really is about passionate commitment to making it happen.
So it's not only, what you're describing here is somebody is not just, this couple in particular, is not just waiting for something to happen with President Obama or candidate Romney and saying, okay, once that happens, then the world can begin. What you're suggesting is there's a much more localized level that with the passion, with the sense of understanding what's involved, we can do it and certainly take some resources to that. Did it take an education process with them, or did they already have an understanding of this, and or was that your role when you came in, Raymond?
No, I came in late in the process as someone who is passionately committed to doing this. But I want to step back on a moment vis-a-vis the challenge you laid out vis-a-vis the presidential election. Actually, the investment tax credit, which was passed actually under President Bush's watch, of the 30% investment tax credit and the accelerated depreciation are really kind of elements that make the transition workable. And so there is a financial commitment not only to private investment dollars, but really creating the infrastructure to really make it financially workable. Under the same act, it's called EPAC 2005, there was also a demand that the oil utilities had to move to net metering. Net metering means that the utilities have to buy back the power at the same rate that they charge you for it. And so there are systematic structural and financial incentives that both the national and state government can have a very significant role in accelerating or discouraging a move to renewable energy.
Beautiful, Raymond. Beautiful. So can you say a little bit about what did they actually have to do to the buildings they were talking about to actually engage PV, engage geothermal? I mean, what was that actual development effort that was involved in that particular project to give people kind of a hands-on sense of it?
Well, so first of all, here we're talking about historic buildings, and two of the buildings were not on site. So they bought a lot. Seven lots, actually, that had three historic buildings. One was built in 1911, one was built in 1913, and one was an old, the Sears Catalog House was actually moved on site. So I guess it only had two historic structures. And so two, it meant physically lifting buildings that were scheduled for demolition because of development, natural development pressure in Florida, and actually moving them on site. So one was sort of a remarkable logistics challenge of picking up buildings and bringing them to the site. And the second thing is really designing not around renewable energy, but designing around making a building much more energy efficient. It means good windows. It means good insulation. It means LED lighting. So not sexy stuff, but really in order to get to net zero energy, to move to a renewable energy economy, what you want to do is design a building that doesn't require the same amount of energy intensity as we typically design for. So that's kind of step two is to work with the structure in such a way that you're going to minimize how many electrons you need to float through the system. The third thing is if you look at Florida, a lot of times it focuses on electricity, you know, wind and solar, but the biggest load in Florida is not for electricity. It's actually for thermal energy, whether it's for heating or for cooling. And so we dug some wells And we dug it in such a way that we have two sets of wells, and so that geothermal water, which is at a constant temperature, can be used by all five buildings to heat and cool the buildings.
Both heat and cool, even for the heat that we have here in the summertime.
Well, so the earth is the water table is generally at a constant temperature. So if you look at the average temperature in Florida or the average temperature in Boston, that's about what the water temperature is. So in Boston, it's probably 55 or 60 degrees. In Florida, it's about 75 degrees. So mm-hmm. if you think about having 75-degree water, it takes less energy to heat or cool a space if you're starting at 75 degrees than if you're starting at 30 degrees or 90 degrees. And that's why the geothermal heating and cooling is more efficient, because you're starting with a temperature that is the annual average, as opposed to starting without with whatever the outside temperature is.
And is that a difficult process to actually really do those wells, drill those wells in the environment, the coastal environment, or is that just a really reasonable and practical thing?
Well, that's not a simple question to answer, but the easy question is it's easy to drill a well, but the water is salty. And as you know, because I know that you're a mariner, salt water is corrosive. Mm-hmm. And so you really have to address the issue that you're dealing with salty, brackish water. And then so there's an expense in drilling the wells. But once you drill the wells and do what's necessary to accommodate the fact that the water is brackish, it's a pretty straightforward to both design the system and install the system, although there's not a lot of experience in Florida. And quite frankly, John, the economics of geothermal are much more compelling when you move into environments that have a much bit larger temperature swing than we have here in Florida.
Right, right. Well, what you're describing then on pillar one is the renewables. This demonstration project is generating all the power that's needed to support these buildings and the functioning for a year?
Well, yes, but the caveat is we're using the utility as a battery.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, during the day we overproduce power and send that out to the utility. It actually flows to the adjoining properties, and that's
right.
metered. And then at night we're using Florida FP&L to provide power. And so when not shining, the solar PV is not producing much power. Although, interestingly, I'll check the site. We have a very sophisticated internet-based monitoring system, and on a day where it's drizzling, this system might be producing 10 or 15 kilowatts, which is certainly enough to power your home. Now, it's a large array, so in other words, the performance degrades, but we still get quite a significant amount of production even on an overcast day in Florida.
So what I'm hearing, though, Raymond, just to start with this first pillar here, is this is all very feasible. This is technology that's understood and recognized, and this is not something that we're on the cutting edge of having to break through to actually have it even begin to be considered. You're actually describing a situation that's a real, tangible project in place, in motion, understood and committed to with passion by a couple of people who really wanted to make it happen.
Exactly. And I will say that the government is very committed to a research program to basically, they call it Sunshot. So earlier I talked about Moonshot, where Kennedy outlined an objective. Sunshot is an objective to get the cost down by a factor of 5 within 5 years.
Wow. Okay, so there are possibilities, coming back to the word I was opening with. This is a tangible possibility that we have here. And it sounds like what's happening then, relative to the possibility, a little different than what Rifkin was describing in terms of hydrogen and basically the storage capacity, but the system that you're describing here, the way that you're engaging with Florida Power, is in fact creating a net zero, and it is in fact creating some system of exchange and a battery, in this case, support to that. Is that what I'm hearing?
Exactly.
Okay. Raymond, I hear the music coming on in our ears here. I don't want to break in because I want to really continue and keep the flow going when we get started on it. Let's take a couple of minutes break. Let's continue, folks. We're trying to bring this alive about understanding the possibilities of here of scale and at the smallest level that we might begin to actually make the kinds of commitments ourselves, begin to develop communities ourselves, and how this might ultimately even be scaled and actually create the full vision of this. But Raymond will be back with us in a moment. Take a break. Come back. You're on Zoomed.
stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
Zoomed Leadership is sponsored in part by Cosmos Journal, the journal for world citizens creating the new civilization. More than just a publication, Cosmos is committed to informing, inspiring, and engaging the world in the transition to an emerging, sustainable, just, and compassionate global culture and civilization that works for all. For over 10 years, Cosmos has been a leading voice that tracks the deep systemic transformations already occurring at the margins of society as our institutions prove unable to serve the needs of the times. Published twice a year in print and digital, Cosmos includes leading-edge articles from social change leaders on the global commons, people power, global governance, new economics, collective intelligence, and cultivating the self. The impact of these paradigm-changing ideas is enhanced through stunning visuals and photographic stories that motivate to action. Start exploring Cosmos Journal and continue opening your perspectives about leadership and the emerging great transition at cosmosjournal.org. Join the Cosmos Leaders of Change and make a difference today. These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's AVASTONE consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoomed. We are here with Raymond Kaiser today. We are talking about how this actually works. If we're considering a third industrial revolution, we're talking about the more landing the plane on the street kind of thing. How is it that we actually make this work? We're talking about the different peers involved in this that Rifkin had laid out in a macro level. And Raymond, we were just talking about this. I started to go the first two peers on this. And I got to tell you, this is an arena that when we talk about energy, this certainly is your bag here. What about this third one about deploying hydrogen and other storage technologies? I started to point to that in relation to the building stock. Can you say a little bit about that to help ground this and where we are on that whole process?
Well, hydrogen and batteries are very different animals, but let's talk about hydrogen first, and then we can talk a little bit about batteries. You know, hydrogen is the most common element in existence. You know, it's first on the periodic table chart. And one of the challenges is it has a remarkable affinity to other materials, which is what makes it challenging. So it's both certainly well available as a fuel source. It's what powers the sun. And yet to try to, and the first electrical hydrolysis was actually done 150 years ago. And actually they used fuel cell to put satellites up into space. So very well understood technology, but it's real challenging. About 5 years ago at Stewart Engineering, we tried to do a sunlight to hydrogen to fuel project for a customer. And it just, it was too daunting. And yet 2 years ago, we did a hydrogen fueling station for, and now this, the first customer was very much passionate and was going to commit the dollars. The second customer was a natural foods distribution center here in Sarasota, and we did a fueling station for their forklifts. And in this particular application, the technology is very well developed and is a much better fit for running. You know, you imagine a forklift. You can't run a diesel engine inside because you choke out your worker
right on. Yep.
And so what they do is they use batteries. But batteries, guess what? Only last 3 or 4 years. It takes them a long time to charge. And so in this application where you need just a little fuel cell and you can fuel these vehicles in basically 2 minutes, and time is money, and it's a fairly significant capital investment. The economics for developing, for using hydrogen forklifts is very well established. So it's really a question of maturation on the hydrogen side. And I don't know where we are on that curve, but recently the government released a report that they thought by 2025, 2030, it was a real possibility, contingent on certain technological breakthroughs. So that's always the caveat that people give you. So let's kind of shift to batteries, because Secretary Chu, who's the Secretary of Energy, used to head up the, he's a Nobel Prize winner, he used to head up Berkeley Labs, and he said that prior to him taking on the responsibility at the Department of Energy, he thought the battery technologies, we weren't going to see major breakthroughs. And he's really changed his tune. There's a lot of interesting chemicals and capacities that have really happened over the last 5 years that are extraordinary. You have Elon Musk, who's the president and CEO of Tesla, also the guy who launched the first private satellite into space to hook up with the space station, and also was the founder of PayPal. He says that we're going to see in the next 2 years some really significant battery breakthroughs. And really the objective is to bring down the cost by a factor of 3 or 4 over the next 5 to 7 years. So I would just say watch this space on the storage technologies.
And so what you're talking about, the actual project does have storage technology, and the way that you're sort of interchanging with Florida Power and Light, you're creating sort of a mirror to that in different ways. And just as Europe was describing, and I pointed to last time, and Rifkin was making note of, is that Europe has committed a fair amount of research and research dollars into this effort, as you're describing, probably in parallel to what we're doing. There's a lot happening, and this is an arena or space where new developments would support this in terms of the larger vision, and probably even be needed, the larger vision. Is that really what you're suggesting as well?
Yes. And in fact, in this project, we have old forklift batteries. That's what we have. We've got 5 kW of forklift batteries, which would give us about 25 kilowatt hours. So you don't need power. You need power over a period of time. And so it's a stopgap to basically provide for some level of energy independence if Florida Power and Light doesn't deliver power, which is, when you're on a barrier island in Florida, happens reasonably frequently.
Yes, it does, as we know so well. Okay, so we've got Pier 1 shifting to renewables. That's what you described in Anna Maria. You talk about transforming the building stock on every continent to micro power plants. That's what you're describing in a sense is on Anna Maria Island. You're describing about the storage technologies, an area for us to look at, but there's things happening there. What about the fourth pillar here, Raymond? And I'm wondering even how the Anna Maria might develop as it goes on. But the fourth one is this, you actually started to point to it, but as Rifkin was describing, it's using internet technology to transform, I guess, the power grid on the continent into an energy sharing intergrid. It's a big vision of this. Maybe you can sort of tease that out, because guys like me who aren't these, don't really tune into this, know the ins and outs of it. Maybe describe that so we get a sense of Anna Maria, where it's going, and the larger grid as a view to the future.
Well, here I have someone, and I wouldn't say a divergence from Jeremy Rifkin, but I have somewhat more nuanced view than Jeremy does in regards to the possibilities for internet technology. So one of the things he does note in his book is he believes that in Europe, there'll be much more of these technologies will be used for distributed power plants. But his feeling is that because of the regulatory challenge and the political power of the industrial and utilities, we'll do much more of a centralized model in terms of using these technologies. And I would say that that's emerging now. So there's been a fairly significant investment in what's called the smart grid. And that conversation is really being dominated by investor-owned utilities, as Jeremy points out, and regulators who are wedded to a centralized generation, transmission, and distribution model. And then the kind of suppliers, whether that be ABB or Siemens or General Electric, they basically believe that there will continue to be the dominance and hegemony of the investor-owned utilities on the energy delivery in the United States. So that's kind of So that's kind of Germer's perspective, and I understand why. Let me hold it.
So what you're describing is, in Europe, what he's describing is a much more decentralized perspective, according to the vision, in which power companies become more managers of the energy as opposed to providers of the energy. But here in the United States, a more centralized view that the power company, the investor-owned utilities, would continue to provide power, and there would be a more integrated sense of the smart grid. Is that the contrasting dimensions there?
Yes, and we are simplifying a little given that we're on radio, but the answer is yes. The reason is there are certain markets which are really quite competitive in the United States. So, for example, Texas, because it was home of Enron, is a totally deregulated market. And so in that kind of environment, you could easily have some, fresh entrepreneur out of the University of Texas at Austin come up with something that could really change the game quite dramatically. So a lot of it has to do with market structure. And so in the United States, some markets are much more deregulated than others. Florida happens to be on the most conservative end of that continuum. In other words, most of the southeastern United States, the markets are fairly heavily regulated, and you haven't disaggregated the transmission operators from the generators and the distribution grid. We have a lot of short answer is we have a lot of monopolies in the southeast United States, and the monopoly model is not as powerful in other markets.
Okay. So it's a different animal of sorts. The vision becomes somewhat different, but before we drive down to the micro level of Anna Maria and the vision, is it possible for us to start to orchestrate a smart grid that would provide some parallel to the sharing energy perspective that Jeremy was describing, or that's the underpinning of an industrial revolution that's suggested?
What I would say is that the political and regulatory constraints in certain markets will have a lot to do with how much innovation emerges in various parts of the United States. And so in Florida, what I have done is I've really kind of thought through what would it be like, given that this is one of the most constipated environments from a regulatory standpoint, how can we do it in such a way that we can still demonstrate what's really possible?
Mm-hmm. And that's what the Anna Maria Project is doing then.
Right. We have a single owner who is producing power, but in Florida it's illegal for her to charge for the power.
Mm-hmm. So how is the vision then of that Anna Maria Island growing in relation to this notion of the intergrid? Is there any further development that's envisioned in further phases?
Well, I see a kind of a maturation that's very different. I'm actually working on an open source energy operating system, which is a whole nother discussion, and I don't think I can concisely encapsulate it. But let me give you an example just more tangibly and concretely around Anna Maria Island. And so really what you have is you have the utility is the provider of choice when the sun's not shining, and when the sun is shining, the project is overproducing. Is producing much more power than they need. And what you have with the local production is tremendous variability. So if you want to really move from a mainframe model to a local area network model to an internet model, first you have to establish a local area network. And so really what we're doing is we're putting in smart controllers where we can independently shut things off. So let's say, for example, this gets to be very technical, but let's say, for example, there's a power interruption at Anna Maria Island, and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Now at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, if it's cloudy, the project will generally produce enough power, but not always. So you have to be able to intelligently shut things on or off. So if it's a restaurant, you don't want to shut off the kitchen. If it's a hot water heater, given that it's the middle of the day, you do want to shut off the hot water heater, and you could shut off a refrigerator, especially if they're residents. It's a mixed-use project. We have office, retail establishments, including a restaurant, and residences. You could shut off a refrigerator for an hour or two, and it's not going to hurt anything, in particular if someone just keeps the door closed. You have a certain amount of thermal inertia. And so really what you want to do is you should want to develop a smart system that can intelligently decide when to shut things on or off and allow the customer to override it. And rather than Florida Power and Light controlling it, it's actually the customer that's controlling it.
Okay, great. I want to pick up on that, Raymond. I hear the music in our ears here for this segment, but let's see if we can maximize time, take a quick and short break, and then come back last segment with Raymond, Raymond Kaiser here, talking about this making the notion of this energy system and the possibility of an energy revolution tangible and real. Come on back in the last segment, folks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network.
Are you tired of the government squandering your tax dollars on bailouts and overpaid bureaucrats? On Free Markets with Dr. Mike Beitler, Mike Beitler and his guests explain why big government regulations are the problem and innovative businesses and free markets are the solution. Listen to Free Markets with Dr. Mike Beitler, Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Network.
Think of the world 50 years ago. Now think of this same world and how it'll be 50 years from now. Did you know that if the world's population continues to grow at its current rate, our children and grandchildren will only have 25% of the resources per capita that our parents and grandparents had? We must preserve the foundation of a quality standard of living. That foundation starts with Go Green Radio. Join your host, Jill Buck, for Go Green Radio every Friday at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Voice America.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, last segment today. Recognize that part of what we're trying to do is put perspective about realities that can be actually engaged and actually executed, where we can actually do something. And the context is there's a larger vision we might move toward, and there's a possibility of the third industrial revolution that Jeremy Rifkin put out there that stimulated in me the notion of how do you get a both-and perspective. You both pay down debt, get us out of the debt, you start to build for the future, and there is the possibility of that, and that's what we're trying to create here. And Raymond, that's really what you were describing on this this particular pillar, as well as getting to the larger vision isn't just a grand leap all the way there. It's that we actually start more locally, and you're using the analogy of scaling down to a local area network for us. Maybe make that a little bit more clear so we can understand what you're really suggesting there with this energy operating system.
Well, John, I was in the computer industry for 20 years, and when I first got into computer industry, it was before the IBM PC had been introduced, and so there was just a lot of little PCs from Radio Shack and Apple and others, but in the corporate environment, they weren't taken seriously. And then IBM introduced a PC, and some people said, oh, maybe I could do a couple of useful things with this, but they weren't really driving line of business applications. In other words, people weren't putting their accounts payable and accounts receivable and manufacturing on these little machines because they lacked the kind of management sophistication and capability that people in the mainframe environment took for granted. So if you have a mainframe, you need to know how reliably you could deliver whatever it is that needs to be delivered. So if it's a truck delivery, you want to be sure it's reliably delivered, and if it's a report to senior management and or getting out the bills, you want to be sure that you've got a really bulletproof system. And so there was a whole tool set that was needed to develop local area networks that gave people the confidence to begin basically divvying up the portfolio. The mainframes got 90% and the PCs got 10%. And then the mainframes got 80% and we bought a couple of little local area networks. And as the sophistication of the tool set grew and the cost of actually deploying distributed computing continued to go down, at a certain point in time we passed a threshold with a primary platform, although there are still mainframes, the primary computing platform is a distributed platform. And so that same kind of maturation, I believe, needs to happen in the energy delivery system.
Wonderful analogy, Raymond. Wonderful analogy. And so what would that look like then? I mean, that's where you start to take Anna Maria Island and build up from that. You talk about it more locally, would you not?
Well, I could even talk about it much more granularly. So, for example, right now we're working at the panel. So typically the service panel, which is where all your circuits come in. So if you have a circuit that controls your lighting for your house, you've got another circuit that usually your hot water heater or other big or stove is on its own separate circuit. Right now the panels we have are dumb. What we're wanting to do is just to put intelligence into those panels so that the owner and a tenant can decide what goes on or what goes off if there's a variability in energy generation. And this actually creates a lot of capacity because a lot of energy production is basically the utility will always overproduce how much they need to generate. They will always overproduce by a fairly significant factor, 10 or 15% at least. And the reason is when you turn on your hairdryer or you turn on your electric lawnmower, the inrush of power requires a burst of power that that the utility always has to overproduce to always take advantage of those, to always be able to meet the demand of those inrushes. Otherwise, your lights dim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have what's called a brownout. And so there's a natural overproduction required. Now, the same thing happens when you have a little local area network of power. And so really what you want to do is just develop a whole soft start capability, an intelligent management capability that gives you the same kind of sophistication that someone in a control environment in somewhere in Florida is doing to manage FPL's 3 million ratepayers. So there's a lot of people in specialized control rooms that are managing a grid. What we need to do is to make very sophisticated tools that are automatically managed that the user can change. So from one's iPhone or one's iPad, one could basically say, oh, goodness, I left a stove on and I'm on a plane to Texas, and to be able to shut that off remotely. And there's no reason technologically we can't do that, and yet there are real barriers to actually making that cost effective.
And is that what part of the Anna Maria project was doing, was starting at that granular level as well?
I'm meeting this afternoon to talk about, we're going to use relays or breakers to basically intelligently be able to shed load so that if FPL is not delivering, that we can intelligently decide what we will power and what we will not power.
So what I'm also hearing, this is not all about out there. This is about what can actually happen, sort of the empowered, committed, actually the starts at this more micro level, local level, to really be able to build the analogy you're describing about this distributed capacity and building up from there. Fascinating, Raymond. Fascinating to flesh this out. I'm wondering if there's anything more there to say, but we had one other pillar, and I know we've only got a couple of more minutes left here, and the last pillar was about the transport fleet. But anything else on that relative to the grid as it relates to the maybe bridging into the transport?
Well, what I would say is that we have historically had a very centralized generation transmission distribution model based on dumb technology. And the investor-owned utilities can take the share of the dollars for a smart grid, or we can invest that same dollar set into moving to a more decentralized model where users have more control.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And is there a magnitude of investment involved in that for homeowners to even think about it?
I'm at the point where we're actually pulling out a pencil and pad tonight to answer that question. But the answer is yes.
Got it. Okay. Close with Raymond. Give us a little sense about this Pier 5 transitioning the transport fleet, meaning our cars, our transport, our buses, and so forth, to electric plug-in fuel cell vehicles or others that connect ultimately to an interactive grid. What about this in terms of realities and possibilities?
Well, the first thing I would say whenever the issue of transportation comes up is that really the best transportation system is the one that we're born with. Basically our 2 feet. And so the real challenge in terms of a transportation system that meets the needs for humanity is to really develop human scale systems where things are closer together and the distances aren't so artificially far. And so it always should include land use and transportation if we want to address the transportation issues. So that's kind of number one.
So a systemic view is really what you're describing, is to hold this whole thing, to even frame it within that larger context to begin with.
One of the sweet things about the historic Green Village, John, is you can walk everywhere. I was talking to someone recently that was saying is they love the fact that they could come there, park their car, and never have to get back in their car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think of going to Hilton Head, and I have never been to Hilton Head. So if someone out there listening is from Hilton Head, I apologize. But I've heard mention of people going on vacation and spending 2 or 3 hours in a car to just go a couple of miles.
Well, I've been there many times. I haven't spent that long on it, but you're right on.
That doesn't sound like much of a vacation.
That's right. Yeah, it sounds like Atlanta traffic, which I left 3 years ago. So, yeah, but you're right on. I think the proximity certainly is one element of this. But what is actually being talked about, and Rifkin was describing that, and relative to the design with the vehicles that are needed, it's actually building some different view or paradigm, which is toward more vehicles that could run off the grid. Does that seem feasible to you?
Well, and again, here I would give you a large depends. The answer is it's yes, we can build an electric car today. They're expensive unless you take out the weight. And mm-hmm. so the first question had to do with proximity. The second would have to do with how much energy is required. In other words, do you need 2,500 pounds to carry around 2,500 pounds with you if you want to go down and get a quart of milk? And as long as it's 2,500 pounds, it's going to require a lot more resource than if you had a vehicle that was only 200 or 300 or 500 or 1,000 pounds. There's a guy who has developed a lot of very famous Formula One cars that's now building a neighborhood electric vehicle. And that's what we need to think of, is different classes of vehicles for different transportation needs.
And so yeah, I think we've had him on the show actually previously. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so that's what I would say is needed, is we really need to appreciate the fact that we're carrying a whole lot more weight around with us to get around than we probably need to. And there are times when and that's what I love about Zipcar. So the answer is yes, we can build electric vehicles, but I think the cost would be too high other than for the most wealthy.
But we're moving toward a new possibility is what we're describing, that new paradigms, new materials, new carbon, no other, you know, Rocky Mountain Institute and others talking about what could actually happen in terms of new designs. The vision actually embraces or holds a larger context, but your point is right on in terms of the scale of it, the cost of it, of where we are, challenges to be had in this pillar. That's right. That is right on. Raymond, well, I can hear the music in our ears here. We probably only have about a minute left. I wonder, closing thoughts, suggestions for our audience in thinking and taking in this perspective about the new possibility?
The most significant source of energy that we have is love. And if we really loved this planet that we're on, we wouldn't be making the kind of investment choices and that we're currently making. It's as if we're waging war on life itself. One of the things that was really interesting in Jeremy Rifkin's book is he talked about humanity is actually now gobbling up at least a third of what's called net primary productivity. And in any given ecosystem, the absolute amount of life you have in any ecosystem is determined by how much sunlight through the process of photosynthesis is translated into organic material. So we're literally gobbling up life itself, and we're doing it at a faster and faster rate, and we're diminishing the capacity of the Earth to continue to renew itself. And so the most important ingredient is not new battery technology or new solar PV technology. The most important step that we need to do is to acknowledge how much we love this place and how much we value it, and value it not based on return on investment, but really value it as an ultimate end, as opposed to an intermediate end.
Right on, right, Raymond. I think that's why we really talk continually about the underpinning consciousness, the heart-centered flow that actually shapes our decisions, our thinking, our views, our connection to the planet, and our recognition of the kind of tragedies that I mentioned as we came on with. I know we're over time here, folks. Raymond, thank you again. We'll continue this conversation next week.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.